session number 10009, reel 3.
Mr. Scannell, reel 3.
Yes, I was digging in with a man. He wasn't a special friend of mine, this chap, because the man I had been digging in had been wounded, and so I had another companion. As I was saying, you have two of you. You dig in pairs. You have a slit trench, two people share. And this man Fenton, a man called Fenton, and I were in the slit trench, and a young subaltern, lieutenant, who'd joined fairly recently with a battery of reinforcements, had came across to the trench and asked us to do something. I can't quite remember what the task was, but it was to go forward. It was something that we didn't consider was wise to do, because there had been quite a lot of mortaring and a certain amount of machine gun fire. There's quite a lot of stuff flying about. And he wanted us to go forward to examine something, to look at something. And I really don't remember what it was. What I do remember is my companion, I didn't say anything, but I left it to Mr. Fenton, who said, "Not on your life." So he just said no. And this young officer said, accused him of cowardice, actually said, "You're yellow or you're a coward," or something like that. Whereupon Fenton, who was any private sergeant like myself, actually said to them, he said, "Fuck off, you stupid little prick," were the words he used. Now, of course, you don't speak to officers like that. At least this lieutenant thought you didn't, but he discovered you do. In action, and in fact, you don't give a damn, really, because, all right, so, "Dear God, you're going to be court-martialed," and so on. You say, "Well, thank God, get me out of here and court-martial me," would be the response. Anyway, this officer was sort of retired and hurt. And a bit later, it was some time later, the same day certainly, he came across, I saw him talking to him, and I said, what was he talking about? He said he was apologising. And this was really quite admirable of the young man, actually, to realise. And what he said to Fenton was, "I came over," he said, "I'm very sorry. Nobody should call anybody a coward in this, you know, in this situation, and I should have known better," which I think was very nice of him, very, very, you know, admirable, I suppose. Rare, too, I think, that kind of humility.
Would he have been considered weak, though, by the men to have apologised?
I think he probably was, actually. I mean, Fenton was fairly contemptuous of him, you know, saying more or less, well, he was sort of sucking up and, you know, trying to get on the right side of him. I think probably that he realised that not a good thing to do at all, to accuse somebody of cowardice.
Can I ask you about poetry and the war, your own poetry? Did you start thinking about writing poetry, or actually writing poetry, whilst you were a soldier?
No, I wrote virtually nothing at all. But then, you see, I was very young. I also do stress this, being uneducated. I hadn't been, as most of the First World War poets were, as I'm sure you realise, sort of not only educated, but educated in the old sort of classical sense. I mean, they had done their sort of Latin prosody and Latin verse and so on, and translations and so forth, and were literate and were educated young men. Whereas I left school when I was 14, went to an elementary school in the 30s, and was scarcely literate. I mean, yes, I had the 3 hours. I mean, I was literate in the sense that I was a very enthusiastic reader, you know, from a very early age. Reading was the one thing I loved to do. Writing too. I mean, I wanted to be a writer from about the age of 8 or 9. I used to, when other boys were doing healthy things like climbing trees or playing football, I was writing my great pirate book and Woolworth's exercise books, things like that. But during the war, I found the whole business of being in the ranks and in the infantry a brutalising business, rather, and I almost stopped functioning in that way, aesthetically or imaginatively. I did read a bit, but only sort of novels and you know, fairly light sort of fiction, escapist kind of fiction, I suppose. I read a bit of poetry too. But on the whole, I certainly didn't write anything much. I vaguely recall trying to write odd bits and pieces, but nothing much. And in any case, I was no good at it anyway. I didn't know enough about it. I started writing seriously when I came out of the army, when I demobbed myself in 1945. And then I got down to really sort of hard work, because I emerged from the army, although chronologically I was, 23. To all intents and purposes, I was an ignorant sort of 15-year-old, really. I was sort of, and I was aware of this incredible ignorance. So I got down to serious writing. So the poems I wrote directly about the war were all written after the war. They're all retrospective. And probably the poem of mine which gets into the war anthologies and so on is in the Oxford Book of War Poetry and various other, and that... what's the Second World War anthology? The Terrible Rain, I don't know if you know that anthology. Well, the poem that's in both of those and in other anthologies is called Walking Wounded. But that was written 18 years after the war. As the poem itself says, it's looking back after 18 years on this particular memory of the war in Normandy.
What's your own technique for going about writing a war poem? Do you have any special techniques which you adopt that you wouldn't adopt for writing a different type of poem?
Not consciously, but I think technique in this way. I am very much a traditionalist in my writing. I tend to write in fairly traditional forms, using traditional meters, very often sort of regular sort of stanza forms and that kind of thing. Not always, but... shall I get Walking Wounded? There's something I could...
In fact, could you please read Walking Wounded now?
Yes, I'll read it and then perhaps comment on a bit on the form. I'll just read the thing. As I say, it's a retrospective war poem written a long time, as the poem itself says. And there's an image which might need a bit of explaining. Fairly early in the poem, there's a reference to birds in Normandy, the absence of birds, and the line says that birds had flown, their green and silent attics sprouting now with branches of leafed steel, hiding round eyes and ripe grenades ready to drop and burst. That's a reference to the German snipers who used to climb up the trees. So instead of birds and in their nests and so on, there were German snipers who would drop grenades on your head or snipe away the leafed steel of the barrel of the rifles, which were camouflaged with the foliage, and I suppose the round eyes of telescopic sights and so forth. I think that probably is the only thing that needs explaining. There's a reference to the Bren, of course, the British light machine gun, and Spandau, which was the German machine gun. Anyway, that's about Walking Wounded. A mammoth morning moved grey flanks and groaned. In the rusty hedges, pale rags of mist hung. The gruel of mud and leaves in the mauled lane smelt sweet, like blood. Birds had died or flown, their green and silent attics sprouting now with branches of leafed steel, hiding round eyes and ripe grenades ready to drop and burst. In the ditch at the crossroads, the fallen rider lay hugging his dead machine and did not stir at crunch of mortar, tantrum of a Bren answering a Spandau's manic jabber. Then into sight the ambulances came, stumbling and churning past the broken farm, the amputated signpost and smashed trees, slow wagon loads of bandaged cries, square trucks that rolled on ominous wheels, vehicles made mythopoeic by their mortal freight and crimson crosses on the dirty white. This grave procession passed, though for a while the grinding of their engines could be heard, a dark noise on the pallor of the morning, dark as dried blood. And then it faded, died. The road was empty, but it seemed to wait, like a stage which knows the cast is in the wings, wait for a different traffic to appear. The
the mist still hung in snags from dripping thorns. Absent-minded guns still sighed and thumped. And then they came, the walking wounded, straggling the road like convicts loosely chained, dragging at ankles exhaustion and despair. Their heads were weighted down by last night's lead, and eyes still drank the dark. They trailed the night along the morning road. Some limped on sticks, others wore rough dressings, splints and slings. A few had turbaned heads, the dirty cloth brown badged with blood. A humble brotherhood. Not one was suffering from a lethal hurt. They were not magnified by noble wounds. There was no splendor in that company. And yet, remembering after 18 years, in the heart's throat a sour sadness stirs. Imagination pauses and returns to see them walking still, but multiplied in thousands now. And when heroic corpses turn slowly in their decorated sleep, and every ambulance has disappeared, the walking wounded still trudge down that lane, and when recalled, they must bear arms again. I think that this particular memory of the war in Normandy, stayed with me all those years, and interestingly to me, it's not a particularly horrific memory of war. I mean, there were much more sort of grand guignol, sort of melodramatic images, which I could, if I wished, summon up the memory of, which one would have thought might be more haunting, but not at all. This fairly sort of low-key memory of the walking wounded after an attack. This was 6th Airborne. We were in support, and they put in an attack at night, and the wounded were coming back the next morning as it got light. I think it was something to do with my own physical condition of exhaustion. You see, one after the landings in Normandy, you landed and you were on the move the whole time, really very little sleep at all, only snatched sort of bits of sleep and crouching in your slit trench, and so I was very, very tired, and this almost sort of somnambulistic state one got into, and almost hallucinatory condition, so that this memory of the walking wounded had that sort of curious dream-like feel about it. And it was this image of war that stuck with me so constantly all those years that in a sense I wrote it in a way to make sense out of it. And why this memory than others? And I came to the conclusion that there's something symbolic about it, that the walking wounded is not only about war, it is about all the disaffected and in fact, it's become a cliche now, this expression. I don't know if you've come across, sociologists tend to talk about the walking wounded as the handicapped and socially and deprived and so on. I rather resent that myself, that it's become a cliche. But I certainly was thinking in those terms. Also, the end there, the walking wounded still trudge down that lane, and when recalled, they must bear arms again. Now, when I wrote that, I think I simply think it's recall to the front, back into action. But suddenly struck me, of course, that's what it's about, recall in the sense of recollection. So it's very much about memory, about the way in which things that happened a long time ago can be more urgently with you, more urgently present than the chronological present.
It's dropped again.
It's about the actual technique, the strategy of making the poem. As with, I suppose, most of the verse I write, at some stage in the writing of the poem, it seems to dictate the kind of direction it wants to go in, the kind of form it wants. And rather interestingly to me about this poem, something happened that I don't think I did consciously, but looking at it, I see that it is written in a kind of form, which is it's a sort of blank verse, in fact, with a good deal of internal rhyming and so on, but it's mainly, roughly anyway, a sort of iambic pentameter line. But what I noticed only after I'd written it is that it's heavily alliterative, almost like Anglo-Saxon alliterative verse, where you get So you get a mammoth morning move, grey flanks and groan. So you've got the mammoth morning move, and then grey and groan. In the rusty hedges, pale rags of mist hung, the gruel of mud and leaves in the mauled lane. Heavily alliterative, and almost each line falls into two alliterative hearts. Smelt sweet like blood, birds had died or flown. And I think that this sort of heavy alliterative stress is somehow enacts the marching and almost a drum beat or there is a kind of military sort of movement about it. At least that's how it seems to me. I think that's probably all I have to say about that.
But that's something that happens unconsciously when you're writing the poem. You don't deliberately set out to reproduce that effect.
I don't think I did, no. It's a long time since I wrote it. I can't actually... I do recall, however, that this poem gave me a great deal of trouble to write. I mean, all poems are quite hard to write, I think, and I usually do quite a few drafts of poems, but this one particularly. I know I tried all sorts of other ways of doing it before it reached the form in which it appears now. And which seems to me probably the right form for it. The first draft, I do recall, I wrote in a kind of free verse, which is not a habit of mine, and which, to my mind, never seems to work really very well. I think that I agree, W.H. Auden says somewhere that about people regarding the strict meter or strict form as being fetters. To fetters upon the ego or something like some such phrase are mistaken. In other words, it releases you from the personal and from the ego. I think this is the whole sort of business of writing poetry is to escape from yourself, really. You're not concerned with the ego. I mean, the personal, as W.B. Yeats says, I think very splendidly, said that in talking of poetry, he said, the personal, all that is personal, he says, soon rots unless it is packed in ice or salt. And by that he means the ice and salt of, you know, objective form, I think.
You're talking about the difficulty you had in writing it. Over what kind of time span would it have been, perhaps, that you...
Over the whole... I think it probably... Not, of course, sitting down every day, 4 hours a day or anything like that, but I think it did take me quite a long time. I think I worked on it over a longish period of about 5 or 6 weeks, I think, before it finally found its form, the form it takes now.
Do you ever work on more than one poem at once?
Not as a rule, no. No. Very, very rarely, no. I usually work on one until it's finished. At present, I'm having written this autobiographical book, Argument of Kings, about experiences in the war. I was working on that. It took me almost, I suppose, best part of a year to write that book, working pretty steadily at it, almost every day. So it was quite a slow, long, slugging job. And, of course, I'm dealing a great deal with these fairly dramatic and traumatic experiences. And obviously it set my mind running a great deal on the war. And what I decided to do, or found myself doing, after I'd finished the book, still thinking in terms of the military matters, and started to write a sequence of poems. I had been looking at and rereading some of Kipling's Barrack Room Ballads, which I think are very fine in their way. The famous ones, of course, are the Danny Deever, the Hanging Danny Deever in the Morning, and, of course, The Road to Mandalay and Gunga Din. These are the sort of popular, famous Kipling poems. But what struck me very forcibly was, as I say, I think they're extremely resourcefully written, resourceful pieces of verse, but the language is not the language of the barrack room. It is a simulacrum. It is an imitation. It is a representation of demotic speech of the barrack room, which in fact bears no real resemblance to it whatsoever. It is in fact the language of the music hall cockney or the Punch cartoon caption. It is a kind of stagey cockney, a kind of stagey vernacular of the barrack room, not the real thing at all. Because anybody who's ever been in a barrack room or served in the army knows perfectly well what the language is like. It is four-letter words. Every other phrase, every third word virtually is an Anglo-Saxon monosyllable. And this is a fact. And I'm sure, although I haven't sort of associated with the soldiery in recent years, I'm quite sure it's the same language now as ever it was. And certainly in the First World War. But of course, the conventions of the orthodoxies of publishing and the Obscene Libel Act and all that prevented people from using the real language. So that's in the novels and accounts of the First World War, you get an extraordinary language. Sort of, I can remember as a boy being rather puzzled that all the soldiers used to talk about mucking this and mucking that. I didn't realise that it was what the word really was. Now, in the post-Chatterley climate, of course, we writers are free to use the words themselves, and this is the freedom of which I'm availing myself in the sequence of poems, and not to a sort of ludicrous extent, but in fact, as I did indeed in Argument of Kings. I mean, if they're going to use Anglo-Saxon monosyllables, that's what they use. I don't use some euphemism or some rhyming thing. Not on the whole. It's true, I use fucking nail as if it's like little nail, but I mean that's just a sort of little joke, really. That's the way it sounded. So that in this sequence of poems, I have, for instance, one called Swearing In, which is a kind of rosary of obscenities, really nothing else, or little else than that. But some of them are I don't know, I find them interesting to do, and I shall, there's one called Troopship, which begins with the troopship sailing out from Greenock, going abroad, and then Letters Home. So you get the various characters, the CO himself, the private soldier writing to his girlfriend, another one writing to his dear mum, and the sergeant major writing to his wife, and so forth. So there's kind of fictional element in it too, which I find interesting.
So, would the soldiers whom you were with, would they react to poetry at all? Did any of them know the barrack room ballads, for example?
Oh no, they wouldn't. No, they virtually, I mean, they didn't read, very, very few. It's very rare to see anybody reading anything at all. And if they were, they would be, I think it was an author called James Hadley Chase, No Orchids for Miss Blandish, seemed to be the kind of thing that they would read, if anything at all. I remember one literary soldier who was a sort of gentleman ranker, I believe he was a solicitor in peace now, although he was only a private soldier, and he used to read the novels of somebody called Thorne Smith, an American comic novelist, who were not especially gifted, I don't think, but certainly no poetry, no.
Coming back to your own technique of writing poetry, you said that you would very rarely write more than one poem at once. Do you find that when you write a poem that you're completely obsessed with it?
I suppose so, yes. I suppose so, yeah.
I mean, do you dream about it? And do you imagine that you've seen phrases?
I think about it a great deal. And I will find myself sometimes waking up in the early hours of the morning thinking about it and possibly even sometimes switch on the light and scribble something down. I did that the other night, in fact. So, yes, it is fairly obsessive, yeah.
Could I ask you about the experience of certain poets like W.H. Auden, whom you've already mentioned, Stephen Spender, who were young men at the time of the outbreak of war, who went to America. Can you understand a move like that?
I can now, yes. I certainly can now. I don't know then, because I knew nothing of it. Spender, incidentally, didn't, of course. Spender stayed in England and was in the fire service in London, in fact. But Auden did, and Isherwood did. They were the chaps who went on. The sort of attitude I understand, as I say, I don't remember at the time at all, but I've read, of course, accounts of that period since. And I believe the press, particularly the gutter press, sort of howling sort of cowards and so forth, Mount Auden and Isherwood. But I think that's absolute nonsense. I don't think it was a cowardly act at all. I do, however, think it was a very sensible thing to do, really. I mean, Auden's view was that as a poet he should be getting on with writing his poetry, and there was no point. He'd have made an absolutely hopeless soldier. He would have been no asset to the British army or any other army. So what he did seemed to me eminently sensible. There is nothing cowardly about him, because during the Spanish War, as you probably know, he went off and volunteered to serve in an ambulance unit. In fact, he was never in action in the Spanish War, as it happened, but that wasn't his fault. I think probably sensibly people kept him away from it because he wouldn't have been of much use. He did in fact end up in the American army in some curious kind of unit towards the end of the war. I've seen a photograph of him in American army officer's uniform, looking surprisingly smart. And I think he was attached to some sort of unit that went around conquered Europe, Northwest Europe, looking for objects of art that the Nazis had stashed away. There was some sort of commission, wasn't there, I believe, searching for these paintings and sculpts and things that the Nazis had stolen from the countries they'd invaded. And, there was some. I think he was involved in that in some way. But I certainly don't. I don't take the view that I'm that kind of man. How does one say it without sounding horribly prejudiced? But all right, we all know, of course, that he was homosexual and so on. But the sort of gutter press and thick-headed view that homosexuals are sissies and cowards is, in my experience, not the case at all. I think they tend to be extremely brave, actually, as far as one can generalize about these things. But I believe one of the American generals, I can't remember which one it was, Patton or somebody like that, was convinced of this, you know, and he used to have as his, although he himself, considers a sort of butch kind of macho man, nevertheless, I believe he used to surround himself with rather dainty sort of young officers, apparently, who were incredibly brave.
It surprises me amongst many intellectuals nowadays that they have an attitude towards people who write poetry about war, an attitude of prejudice, especially when one considers some of the greatest poetry in the history of poetry has actually been about war.
Is there a prejudice? I didn't know that. Mm.
Perhaps reflecting pacifist feelings or anti-war feelings amongst many intellectuals nowadays. But do you find that yourself amongst young people you meet at university?
No, I don't think so. I think they're quite... I mean, the poetry that I've written of war is, of course, a very personal kind. I was saying one shouldn't, you know, one has to be aware of the person... It's not personal in the sense that it is about... my feelings necessarily, and yet it is in a way. I mean, that Walking Wounded, I mean, I hope it's more sort of deals with sort of broader universal issues, but it is very much a private experience, of course, that it deals with. And I did a sequence many years ago now, so 25 years or so ago, called Epithets of War, which is a quotation from Othello, when he talks, Othello talks about epithets of war. And this sequence begins with in the First World War, 1914, which, you know, I wasn't even born in the First World War, but it's part of a kind of ancestral memory, really. I seem to remember the First World War more vividly than the Second. It's one of those extraordinary ironies, in a way, simply because I was brought up on it. I mean, I was born in 1922. So that's, 4 years after the end of the First World War. But it was very much in the air at the time, that sort of post-war time when I was a child, so that there were a lot of publications, sort of, I can remember, magazines about it, sort of histories of the war, with lots of photographs of No Man's Land and the trenches and going over the top and so on. My father's and uncles and so on.